never hurt anybody. They were trying to help. And there's no reason for their slaughter.
Jim was just innocent, and they knew it. They knew that Jim was just a symbol for our country. And it's that hatred that Jim was against.
John and Diane Foley, the parents of journalist James Foley, speaking at a press conference this morning. The Islamic militant group ISIS posted a video online yesterday of Foley being beheaded. It was titled "A Message to America." U.S. officials and Foley's family today confirmed the video as authentic. Foley was captured nearly 2 years ago while reporting in Syria, and it was thought he was being held by forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime. It's not clear how he ended up in the hands of ISIS. Charlie Sennett is co-founder of Global Post, a news group that Jim Foley reported for. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I'm very sorry for your loss. What was the last contact that you and Global Post had with Jim?
Well, the last contact was in the days just before Thanksgiving, 2 years ago, when Jim was on assignment. And it was sort of a chaotic time, if you remember that, in Syria. It was when everything was shifting. And what seemed like a place where journalists could work a few months before that last contact had become a place where it was just incredibly dangerous. And, there are so many ways we look back on this and so many lessons to be learned about how journalists work in the field. We take it very seriously at Global Post about our people in the field, and worked very, very hard, and were very, very hopeful that we would get Jim Foley home. And I can't tell you how devastated we all are at Global Post that's not what happened, and that a life as bright as Jim Foley's ended in such darkness is just almost impossible for us to handle right now. Our greatest concern, very candidly, is for the Foley family and for the journalists or the other captives whose lives are at stake right now and really hanging in the balance.
Right. There's another journalist seen on that video who was threatened with a similar fate. And do we know how many other journalists are being held captive in Syria right now?
We don't have a precise number, and I know all of the information is very guarded, and I'm going to try my best to avoid any details because I just don't want to say something that could inadvertently put any of them at risk. I would love to, if I could, turn back to the tape that you started the interview with of the Foleys. John and Diane Foley are some of the most extraordinary people I've ever met. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've met a lot of people. I've worked as an editor sending journalists out in the field, and I know a lot of journalists. Jim Foley was unique, but his parents are equally unique. They are extraordinary in their faith. They're extraordinary in their faith in God, but they're also extraordinary in their faith in their son and their faith in what he did as a journalist. And his idea that his work mattered and that he wanted to do the kind of work that could make a difference. And I think hearing them express such a deep and really heartfelt belief that he accomplished that goal, that they're proud of their son for the work he did, is something that's really holding us all up at Global Post. We are devastated, but when we hear Jim's parents really articulate the whole meaning of what we do, we can take some solace in that, and their strength is really holding us up, if that makes sense. I mean, they are that extraordinary.
Well, when you grapple with the death of Jim and the fact that there are other journalists held in captivity there, and you think about your mission and your mission as an organization and your mission as a journalist, how do you balance the two, the mission and the obvious dangers?
Yeah, it's a great question and a really hard question, one that I struggle with myself every day, literally. And I have worked a lot in Iraq and in Afghanistan and all over the Middle East, and I have taken a lot of extraordinary risks myself. I'm a father of four, and I really understand the calculus of risk for journalists in the field. And I think it comes down to always feeling like you're adding something, you're adding value, what you're doing has meaning, and that keep checking yourself that you're not doing this to be a cowboy, that you're not doing this for some thrill or some addiction. And these are questions for journalists who do this kind of work that Jim Foley did that we ask ourselves in the field every day. And it's the only way you can do it is to keep checking yourself and keep asking. And even if you're someone as questioning and passionate as Jim, horrific things can unfold very fast. And in this instance, that is what happened.
And does it get to be a point, especially when you consider Syria and then what's happened with ISIS in Iraq, that the mission has been more frustrating as time has gone on, in the fact that this crisis doesn't seem to be ending, this war doesn't seem to be ending. It seems to be getting even more complicated as the United States begins its military action in Iraq. And so I guess I'm wondering if you find, and if journalists like Jim Foley expressed any kind of frustration in covering something and trying to bring light to something that seems unending and the rest of the world doesn't seem to be paying much attention.
You know, war is always frustrating. And that's because it's a ridiculous way to try to work out a problem. And I think if you've really covered a lot of war, you know how ridiculous, and this may sound strange, but how boring it is. It is hours and days and weeks of boredom interspersed with moments of sheer fear and panic and sometimes terror, which I am sure Jim experienced when he realized he was being taken. And I don't know how to express that other than to say, if you've been around it enough, the same feeling gets you all the time, that there are innocent people who are caught up in forces that are way beyond their control. And if you really listen to Diane and John Foley's statement, they articulate this so beautifully, that is why Jim Foley was there. He was there because he wanted to be there with those people to really tell their story of what it was like for the Syrian people to be living under both the tyranny of the Assad regime and the tyranny of the violence all around them and the tyranny of ISIS or ISIL. And I think he had a unique voice that way. He really got to the people. He really wanted to tell their stories. He really cared. And I think a voice like that in a war is, to me, the best of war coverage, because they aren't excited about it. They aren't thrilled to be there. They aren't thinking that this is productive or exciting. They have an edge on observing just how absurd and frustrating it always is.
Well, Charlie, I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts today with us.
Thank you.
Charlie Sennett, co-founder of Global Post. That's a news group that James Foley reported for. Charlie Sennett is also executive director of the Ground Truth Project. That's an organization that trains international correspondents. Well, British officials are trying to confirm whether the masked man who beheaded James Foley is a citizen of the UK. Prime Minister David Cameron returned early from vacation to address this and has said it's become increasingly likely, his words, the man is British. ISIS has, by some estimates, thousands of foreign fighters, many from the U.S. and Europe. And joining us to talk about this is Andy Liebman. He's senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Madeline.
Well, this video, if it was a British fighter who, in fact, killed Jim Foley, is this video being used as a recruiting tool for other Westerners to join the fight, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. First, it, I think, portrays the sophistication of the ISIS propaganda machine. You know, they were aiming to make the biggest possible impact on a particular audience, which is the West, us. I mean, this isn't really a recruiting tool, I think, as much as it is a terror tool. And they're trying to terrorize an audience, and that's us. But, you know, it does remind us, and I think we've all known, that Syria has been a magnet for foreigners. More foreigners have gone to Syria to fight than, I think, any other jihadist battlefield in recent memory.
And why is that?
I think a couple of things. First of all, it attracted Sunnis because they were fighting against a minority Shia regime in the Alawites, the Assad regime in Syria. So this started not at all as a typical West anti-Western jihad, but rather as an anti-Shia jihad. And it attracted lots of Sunnis from the Arab world, a few from Europe, a handful from the United States. And I think, you know, the saying success breeds success really applies here. As ISIS and the other jihadist fighters gained, as they made progress against the Assad regime, they recruited more and more people. And I think what's happened in Iraq over the last couple of months really speaks to that. Now they've got, you know, success on the battlefield, they've got money, they've got new weapons, and that's what they're using, I think, to attract new recruits.
And what is the benefit for them to attract foreign recruiters, to foreign fighters, fighters from places like Britain or Europe?
Well, I think, first of all, they aren't picky about who they're recruiting. And it's, you know, I think it's important to really distinguish ISIS and what's going on right now in Syria and Iraq from what we knew about al-Qaeda back in the old days, back before 9/11 and in the immediate aftermath. Al-Qaeda was a very small, very selective, focused organization. They sought to attack the West and attack the United States and kick us out of the Middle East. And they could afford to be extremely selective about who they accepted into the organization. ISIS and the jihadist organizations in Syria and Iraq are really more insurgent organizations. They need mass. They need lots and lots of recruits. They need people who are willing to die on the battlefield. They're facing, you know, armies of well-armed individuals. So they need people from all over. And the other thing that Westerners bring them is the potential, eventually, to turn their skills against the real enemy, which is the West. And we shouldn't forget that while the immediate goal is to overthrow Assad and to establish a caliphate, the ultimate goal of Baghdadi is also to attack us.
So does that mean the foreign fighters would then return to the U.S. or Europe and return with military training?
I think not necessarily. A lot of them will die. A lot of the recruits that they bring into the battlefield are there as cannon fodder. In Iraq, many of them were used as suicide bombers. So many of the volunteers will not survive the battle. But it certainly gives them the opportunity. And I don't know. There haven't been very many examples of Westerners who've returned. We've had Somalia where Westerners went to help fight, and Iraq, and that it didn't turn out to be as dangerous as people thought. They didn't actually stream out and attack their previous homeland. So I think, you know, it bears watching, and a great number of governments are focused on what to do about their citizens who've gone.
Andy Liebman is senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and worked for many years at the CIA. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, how ISIS is using the internet as a propaganda tool and how the internet is responding. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been discussing the execution of journalist James Foley by Islamic extremists. The video of his beheading first hit the internet yesterday via YouTube and then spread quickly through Twitter. YouTube removed that video, and now Twitter is trying to remove every single tweet that contains the video or images of it. But is that even possible? Alex Goldman is here now. He's producer for WNYC's On the Media, and he co-hosts the podcast TLDR. Hi there.
Hi.
So what exactly is Twitter doing to try to stop the spread of this video and its images?
Twitter CEO Dick Costolo has said that he's actually trying to remove and suspend any account that is posting either still images or the entire video. Now, the video is being taken down pretty regularly from YouTube, but it just gets thrown back up there pretty much right away. ISIS and people who are sympathetic with ISIS are basically just perpetually re-uploading it. And if their accounts get banned, then they just create new accounts and so on and so forth.
So it seems like ISIS is pretty sophisticated when it comes to social media.
Actually, On the Media last week had a photojournalist named Sebastian Meyer on the show, and he spoke specifically about their media savvy when it comes to images and how they use images not just to deliver a sort of very strong image, but to actually strategically, in order to strike fear in certain parts of the region in Iraq when they are making advances militarily. So they are very, very sophisticated in terms of using the internet and how they share information. They are using it specifically to strike fear in certain ways.
Is this something that websites like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube have ever had to encounter before? And do they have the means to counter it?
Facebook has a pretty robust mechanism to take down inappropriate images, graphic images. YouTube actually has a group of people whose full-time jobs are dedicated to removing this kind of information. Twitter is not so much the case. They tend to sort of let things stand no matter how gruesome they are. They slap a 18-up warning on them if you're not logged in. But if you're logged in, you pretty much sort of get everything uncensored. This is kind of an unprecedented move for Twitter.
Meanwhile, there's a Twitter hashtag going around. The Twitter users are responding. It's called hashtag ISIS Media Blackout. Tell us about that.
Basically, people are so disgusted by this image, and they are trying to sort of counteract exactly what ISIS is going for. ISIS is using these images to score political points and to advance strategically this propaganda. So the ISIS Media Blackout hashtag are people who are just making a concerted effort not to get this information shared. In fact, people who are friends with James Foley have been tweeting pretty regularly, you know, let's remember him this way, and posting images of him in the field or smiling or with holding the camera up to his face and saying, don't post these pictures or this video. Post instead pictures of this person doing what he loved and in his element.
Okay, let's move on to another phenomenon on the internet, the Ice Bucket Challenge. And anyone who has been online recently has seen this probably, people, including celebrities, calling out their friends online to say that they either have to pour a bucket of ice water on their heads or donate $100 to ALS research. And the biggest name to do this was our former president, George W. Bush.
I've been challenged by several Americans to bring awareness to the ALS campaign. To you all who've challenged me, I do not think it's presidential for me to be splashed with ice water, so I'm simply going to write you a check.
Ow!
That check is for me. I don't want to ruin my hairstyle.
Okay, so that's Laura Bush dousing her husband. And this has just swept social media. It's really incredible. And so what do you make of all this?
You know, it's odd. Personally, I think it's a little silly. I think that it doesn't raise so much awareness about ALS, so much as it does raise awareness about your tolerance for having ice water thrown on you. At the same time, I think that part of the reason I feel that way is just because the component of it that really matters, the fundraising, is sort of the least front-facing component of this. The most front-facing component of this is the sort of show-offy, ridiculous element of it. But the ALS Association released a press release yesterday saying that they raised $22.9 million this year in the same span of time that last year they raised $1.9 million. Mm. And they had over 500,000 donors. So that is a direct result of the Ice Bucket Challenge. So clearly it's a success raising money for ALS. I'm not sure how much it's raised awareness to what ALS is exactly. I did see one where a guy got the bucket dumped on his head, and afterward he screamed, yeah, woo, AIDS. I mean, ALS.
Yeah.
So it's an open question as to people whether people know exactly what they're doing it for.
Right, ALS being Lou Gehrig's disease, and something that is pretty rare and incurable at this point, and not a lot is known about its causes. And I guess it's raising a lot of moral questions in terms of donations to charities and whether or not these dollars would be better spent going to other charities and whether or not it's diverting charitable funds away from those other worthy causes because of this, you know, very viral, fun, media-friendly campaign.
I mean, this is the same discussion we had around the Kony 2012 video, right?
Yeah.
It caused a lot of attention for this one particular cause to the neglect, I suppose, of other causes. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think that there's a finite amount of attention that people can pay to certain things at a given time. And as long as people are giving to something that they didn't previously know existed, that sort of ranks as a success, in my opinion.
And I guess it's really kind of a mystery as to why this. Why this, out of all viral videos or non-viral videos, why did this one become such a hot ticket?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think at least part of it is the challenge component. In the same way that sending chain letters was popular for 45 seconds in the late 90s, saying to someone, I now challenge you, and you to do the same thing or donate. I guess that people feel that a call to action only matters when they're called out by name.
Okay, go ahead. I'm calling you out, Alex.
I'm going to write a check. I'm definitely not going to throw a bucket of ice on my head.
Alex Goldman co-hosts the podcast TLDR, which covers life on the internet. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Have you been challenged to dump a bucket of ice water on your head? Did you do it? Did you not do it? Why? Why not? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Being a Bad Feminist, Roxane Gay's new book of essays explores race, sex, and pop culture, her take on Robin Thicke, rape reporting in the New York Times, and why she does not want to see any more slave narrative movies. All that after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Everybody get up. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, so you're in your car and the beat drops. The song is hot. But wait, what did he just say? He knows I want it. He hates blurred lines. It's kind of sexually aggressive, I think. Anyway, it's situations like this that have Roxane Gay caught between a rock and a hard place, or to be more specific, between pop culture and feminism. She's just released a book of essays called Bad Feminist, in which she explores the tension between her love of pop culture and the fact that she's a feminist and lots of other topics. Roxane Gay, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Madeline. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's just start with this title that you have, Bad Feminist. And a lot of why you assign yourself this appellation has to do with pop culture. You really enjoy shows like, let's say, Law & Order SVU, which is, you know, not exactly embracing the feminist ideal. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, on your kind of guilt, your guilty feelings about embracing these aspects of our culture that you know you shouldn't.
Yes, definitely. It started tongue-in-cheek, where I wanted to claim feminism, but I kept realizing, oh my God, I'm really not very good at it. And so I started calling myself a bad feminist. But when I look at the popular culture that I enjoy and that I consume, a lot of it has really problematic messages for women. And so, you know, one of my favorite television shows is Law & Order SVU, and I have no regrets about that. But at the same time, I want to be able to critique that show. I'm able to take pleasure in The Bachelor and Law & Order and Criminal Minds and all of these shows that have some really strange things to say about women and the female body. And at the same time, I am able to talk about what's wrong and hopefully inspire the next generation of content creators to do better for women.
But then part of you really just likes it, likes the entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
So you shut off that critical part of your brain and you just get into
it. Sometimes you have to. Sometimes you just have to. I mean, the struggle I mean, it, of course, it's a luxury to be able to say this, but sometimes the struggle needs to take a break. And I'm willing to take that break. And there are certain things that I can't consume anymore, like Blurred Lines is a song I no longer really allow myself to listen to because it's catchy and all, but I think the price of enjoying that song is greater than the value the song offers. But for the most part, I try to just relax and just be human.
Well, that's an interesting point, the being human part, because I think a lot of women now, successful intellectual women now, disavow the word feminist. They say they're not feminist because they don't think it is about being human. They think it's about being some strident militant, humorless strident militant who doesn't shave her legs. So why do you think that, that cliche or that idea has taken root so firmly, that that is what we think of when we think of the word feminist?
I think a couple reasons. One, I think that people lack imagination. And so they're still thinking of the caricature of feminists that emerged from the 60s and 70s, when feminists really didn't have any room to be funny because they were up against issues that were so pressing and so dire that they had to be strident and they had to fight constantly. And I also think that the people who have the most to lose when feminism succeeds are very invested in painting feminists as something negative. And it's really unfortunate when you see really intelligent women buy into this narrative of what a feminist is, because it's not true. And it's a disappointment. Especially, you know, I think Melissa Leo, I read an interview once and I wrote about it.
The actress.
That she, yes, the actress, that she disavows feminism. And I thought, oh my God, Melissa, you, and we're not on a first name basis, but you are so fierce. How could you say something like that when you really clearly embody feminism in everything you do?
Well, a lot of people say we're post-feminism. We're post all that, that we don't need
ridiculous.
To label ourselves that because we are equal now. We can do whatever a man does.
Yeah, and we can get paid 77% of it for the same work. I think anyone who thinks we're post-feminist is absolutely delusional, and I would love to join them in that delusion, but we're not there. We're having a national discussion about birth control in 2014. No, we're not post-feminist.
You have an essay in your book called The Careless Language of Sexual Assault, where you dissect the way we speak about rape and the words we use and how we report on rape as journalists. And you use a specific example of a New York Times article about the gang rape of an 11-year-old girl in Texas to illustrate that. And I just want you to elaborate on that a little bit for us now. And are you saying that we no longer as a culture take rape seriously?
No, I think we do take rape seriously in certain quarters, but we don't in others. And when that article first came out, I was struck by how the writer was very worried about that poor, poor town and those poor boys. And, oh, how will the town recover? And I was worried about the 11-year-old girl. You have to think more carefully about how you write that story. Because, yes, when you live in a small town and something like this happens, there are going to be repercussions. But, you know, let's start with Ground Zero and the young girl that was raped. So I'm really concerned with how we talk about sexual violence. I think sometimes we feel so inundated by stories of sexual violence that we become numb to it and we start to become cavalier. And I think that when we use careless language, we also continue to enable that culture of cavalierness. And in that essay, I was definitely writing against that notion that we should be cavalier or careless when it comes to writing about sexual violence.
And you reveal your own story. You talk about the fact that you had a traumatic, very traumatic experience when you were a middle school student in the woods with a bunch of boys, and it has changed your life.
Yes, it has.
And I guess I'm just wondering how exactly you deal with that now that you're an adult and you're a lot older, and how you think about what happened in the woods that day.
You know, it's definitely something that I still think about and still deal with. I mean, there are repercussions, you know, that affect my fertility that are frustrating to deal with. And so there's that constant reminder. Just anything can, you know, just push you into a flashback. And so it's just, it's this constant weight on your shoulders. But certainly the older I get and the further I get from the incident, the easier it is to just make it through the day without freaking out And I've had a lot of help and a lot of support and therapy. And so I'm in a really good place. And so now I'm in a place where I can talk about what happened and let other women and men know that it's okay to give voice to your story when you're ready to give voice to your story, and that you should maybe try and trust the people in your life a little more. I certainly wish now that I had trusted my parents back then, but I was very young and I was very scared, and we were strict Catholics, and I just, you know, children, we don't make rational decisions about these kinds of things. And so I didn't trust them. But I hope that the more we talk about these issues, the more young children will feel comfortable saying, this happened to me and I need help now.
And did that experience shape you in terms of your feminism and how you later viewed men and how you later in terms of your academic writing? And
yeah, of course. Yeah, it's definitely shaped my feminism in that it makes me extra aware of rape culture. Mm-hmm. And it makes me take into consideration the kinds of issues that women deal with when they deal with violence. And there are gradations of violence, certainly, but we definitely, I do think, live in a culture where violence is pervasive. And so I'm aware of that. And that definitely shapes my writing and my thinking. But the older you get and the more distance you have between yourself and trauma, the more you're able to separate the bad deeds of individuals from the character of an entire group of people.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Roxane Gay. She has a new book, a collection of essays called Bad Feminist. And you also were talking about violence against women, and you really take a lot of the movies that have come out, these sort of slave movies, or, you know, 12 Years a Slave, for example, and Django and Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's movie, as relishing in this violence, especially violence against women.
Yes. I think in those movies, we see a lot of violence against women and we see violence against the black body, and almost a fetish for displaying the black body being violated. Now, certainly there's context there, and to accurately convey the horrificness of slavery, we need to go there. And I have no problem with that. But at times it seems gratuitous and it doesn't seem organic to the plot of whatever story is being told, and that gets frustrating. And then part of me is just burnt out on those images. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean those images shouldn't exist. It just means that I no longer need to consume them. Especially in the essay where I write about 12 Years a Slave, what I really want to see is, in addition to having this body of work about slavery, I would love for us to also have a more robust body of work about black people that isn't grounded in the struggle.
I thought also what was interesting in that essay that you wrote about 12 Years a Slave was the role of Lupita Nyong'o, her character, and
yes,
how her role was to create and to show the suffering in the lead, the male character.
Yes. It was really, it kept coming at me the way her character, Patsy, suffered so that Solomon Northrup could really feel some anguish. I mean, his situation was already full of anguish and he had every reason to suffer. But it seemed like his suffering was always augmented by Patsy's suffering. It just drove me crazy.
To see her suffer and to see him look pained, watching her suffering rather than,
you know, bearing some of that suffering himself. And as a feminist, to see no sort of resolution to her story was frustrating. But again, I just think we deserve a broader spectrum of black entertainment. Like, our lives are not strictly grounded in the struggle. We have other stories to tell.
And you're not saying Tyler Perry's a good alternative.
Oh, no. Come on.
Yeah.
Now, Tyler Perry is a complicated topic. I think his movies are absolutely terrible. I think that he has appalling messages to say about women. I think he is extraordinarily destructive. But he also owns the only, I believe, black-owned movie studio. He owns and produces and directs and often stars in his own properties. And so as a businessman, I admire a lot of what he's done. And I believe that moving forward, we're going to see him continuing to foster other black media people or movie people. But I mean, because he's the only one, we have to be grateful? I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be grateful. And that movie, the one about the marriage therapist who had an affair and then she gets HIV.
Oh, yeah.
That movie, to my mind, fully explained everything that's wrong with Tyler Perry. And that it exists is just so desperately disappointing. And that he thought it was an acceptable message to send, that if you cheat, you're going to get HIV or AIDS. And that you are a loose woman, and that wanting your husband to love you more and treat you better is somehow unrealistic for a Black woman. I was completely offended.
So does anyone get it right when it comes to pop culture and the Black experience and the Black female experience?
Shonda Rhimes does amazing work. I love everything Shonda touches. It's not perfect, and it doesn't need to be perfect, but at least she tries, and she has really... diverse casting and diverse in all kinds of ways. We see different kinds of bodies to some extent. We see different people of different races and ethnicities and religions and physical ability and sexuality. And I commend her for doing that. And she also makes her stories more than the struggle. It's rare in a Shonda Rhimes show that you're going to see race as the be-all to end-all of her character's motivations. It's just one part of who they are.
Roxane Gay's new book of essays is called Bad Feminist. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
All right, we have here a bad feminist. I'm going to say that. And I mean bad fill in the blank.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a compliment.
I didn't say it on the air, really, but you know what I mean.
World's best bad journalist. Yes. Spilling in for Warren Olley.
Three letters. Okay, that didn't work. Barbara Bugave is here. Yay. Filling in for Warren Olley.
Thank you, Madeline. Yeah, so we're on other sides of the desk. Now I'm filling in for Warren. And on To the Point today, we're talking about something you're probably interested in, the rising cost of college and whether college is worth it. Mm. And if you think it's not, what's the alternative? So maybe you saw the piece in the Atlantic about Minerva, this experiment in a whole new alternative brand of higher ed. We'll talk to the editor and writer of that piece and also talk about how you pay for college.
Well, it's worth it in terms of lifetime earnings, right? College graduates make more money.
Yes, but there's a point where that tips out of balance.
And
are we approaching that point?
Okay, well, that looks like it's going to be a very interesting conversation coming up at 1 o'clock on To the Point. Barbara Bugave filling in for Warren Olney. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on this program, we remember the father of Iyengar yoga and also Deborah Sussman, iconic Los Angeles designer. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. BKS Iyengar, the world famous yoga guru, died in India today. He was 95 years old. He was one of the main people who popularized yoga in America, turning a centuries-old spiritual practice into a fitness routine for some 20 million people here. Iyengar's particular brand of yoga is taught all over the world, but throughout his career, he remained conflicted about the ancient discipline's transformation into a multi-billion dollar industry. Here he is on CNN.
Yoga is a science. Today, it has become a commercial presentation. It's painful to me. I don't think that yoga is going to survive.
William Broad is here now. He's senior writer for the New York Times and author of the book, The Science of Yoga. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much.
Well, when did he come here, and how did Iyengar popularize yoga here in the West?
Oh, you know, he did it through his book, Light on Yoga, which was published in 1965. It hit like an explosion. Here was this this talented young man twisting himself into all kinds of incredible poses that get laid out in this book in beautiful pictures, you know, hundreds of them, in every kind of outrageous pretzel pose that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And people loved it. They ate it up. Not only that, he very cleverly marketed this ancient practice as very modern. You know, the light that he talks about in the title of the book was, you know, the light of our new scientific era. And he would talk a lot about the different cures that doing yoga could produce. So at the end of the book, you get almost 100 different conditions and illnesses that he says can be treated with yoga. So he did a kind of brilliant sales job in combining this very old thing in a brand new format.
And I guess he was his own best advertisement for that because he was born during an influenza outbreak. He had tuberculosis, right, malaria, right, typhoid.
Right, yeah. He healed himself early on in his life. And then in midlife, he had a horrible motorbike accident in which he smashed himself all up and broke all kinds of bones. And presto, put himself back together again just by being this incredibly rigid, willful disciplinarian with himself.
And was he also very charismatic? I mean, we've seen other leaders of other kinds of yoga, Bikram, for example, as a kind of charismatic figure. Also, in the case of Bikram, a controversial figure when it comes to some allegations of sexual assault. Was he that kind of charismatic figure to women and to others?
I think not in that way. I mean, one of the things I think that sets him apart is that he didn't have a lot of this touchy-feely, new-agey kind of stuff about him.
Mm-hmm.
And it also goes to, you know, his bundle of contradictions in a way. You know, he was a rigid disciplinarian and could be quite inflexible and tough. He was more like a drill sergeant than a spiritual master. And he would poke people and say rude things. You know, books have been written about his abrasive style and how, you know, he just would drive people crazy. So he has a huge following, and he's like a god to many of his devotees. But that at the heart of it is a very human person who in real life was a bundle of interesting contradictions.
Well, how was he able to become, as you say, a god to many devotees? What was it about him?
You know, he came in. We have a beautiful obituary in tomorrow's paper written by my colleague, Ellen Berry, who quotes lots of people. And basically, he was in the right place at the right time. Yoga, there was this yearning in the 60s, right, for something beyond, mm-hmm. you know, the little boxes on the hillside. And a younger came along, and he had an excellent product. And it sold, and it sold, and it sold, and it went global. And one of his geniuses was that this rigid discipline that he applied to himself and to his students, he applied to his business. I mean, if you want to become an Iyengar teacher, you undergo years of training, not weeks, not months, years, right? No other style gets close to that. It's this incredible branding integrity, and that's appreciated out there in the world. He was also, and this is also one of his contradictions, he was so rigid and so tough in so many ways. He was also incredibly innovative, and that accounts for a lot of his success. When he would, you know, prescribe these tough postures, shoulder stands and headstands, these iconic things that can get you in trouble, that can produce injury, he innovated. He created this whole method of that we now use widely of blocks and straps and blankets to make, the first person fit the pose rather than the pose fitting the person. Right? He learned. He grew. He figured out how to make yoga safer for a lot of people.
So how would you describe it as different from other forms of yoga? How is it distinctive besides using the props?
This is oversimplifying it, so for all you sophisticated listeners out there, please don't get angry with me. But you can divide yoga into two big branches, static yoga and moving yoga. You know, the one where you hold positions and one where you move through positions, like in flow yoga or mm-hmm. in Ashtanga and that kind of stuff. he, you know, was the architect of the perfection of the static style, of going into these poses and holding them, and often in long meditative kind of states. That was the younger trademark, and it's still practiced widely around the world.
Now, you wrote a book called The Science of Yoga, and so tell us if you've unpacked some of the health claims that he's made in terms of his style of yoga.
Yes and no. I mean, one of the people, the book goes into a lot of detail on the things that are dangerous, but it also profiles this guy, Lauren Fishman, a wonderful, brilliant, really medical doctor on the east side of Manhattan, who went and studied with a Iyengar in Pune back, you know, before he went to medical school, and learned all kinds of tricks from this great master, and then has also, you know, kind of gone and run with the Iyengar's innovation streak and created all kinds of new yoga-based healing innovations. So it cuts both ways. There are things that are dangerous. I don't do shoulder stands anymore. I've read the clinical literature. I don't do plow position. You know, it can get you in serious trouble. But yoga can heal, and yoga definitely can help you unwind and make you feel great. And in this world, that's a wonderful thing. And I would say, you know, Iyengar was the giant. He was the guy who really put yoga on the map.
Well, William, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Good talking to you.
That's William Broad, senior writer for the New York Times and author of the book, The Science of Yoga. And we were remembering Iyengar. He died yesterday in India at the age of 95. Someone else Angelenos may have heard of died yesterday, Deborah Sussman, a pioneer in environmental graphic design. She was 83 years old. Sussman started her career 50 years ago in the offices of Charles and Ray Eames, the modernist architects and designers. She went on to create work all over Los Angeles, including the landscape for the 1984 Summer Olympics held here. Frances Anderton hosts KCRW's architecture and design show, DNA, and she's here now to remember Deborah Sussman. And the look of those Olympics was particularly exuberant.
Exuberant and also low cost. Those Olympics became famous for actually not being a massive drain on the resources of a city, because LA made the radical decision to actually do a kind of a temporary installation that they called the Olympics. And Deborah Sussman, together with the architect John Jurdy, she came up with the most astonishing environmental design, essentially an amazing colour scheme of pinks and oranges and blues and incredibly vivid colours that were supposed to capture the look of the Pacific Rim to celebrate the games being here. And she applied that colour scheme to inflatables, to scaffolding, to cardboard. It was an amazing sort of temporary installation that put her work on the map as utterly unafraid of colour.
And you can see that in her latest work. I'm assuming it's her latest work, which is the design in Grand Park, benches.
That's correct. One of her very recent projects. Deborah never stopped working. If you ever met Deborah, she was the most energetic person. I mean, she's passed now, very sadly, at 83, but she was working more or less up to the last minute. And yes, her firm designed the colour scheme and the signage for Grand Park, where she picked up on the green of a park and she gave it a vivid green and pink palette. It's really added to the attraction of that park.
And then she herself also embodied her own design sensibility.
Oh, Deborah was amazing. I mean, Deborah was a style icon. Deborah would walk in, she always had the most stunning outfits, the most stylish of shoes, the most adventurous colours, far more adventurous than people 50 years younger than her. And essentially, she kind of looked like her work. She and her work were of a piece.
And she really, I guess, embodied the exuberance of Los Angeles.
I'd like to think so. I wish all of LA were as vivid as she were, you know. But yes, absolutely. She embodied the kind of make do, use the materials to hand. She was very much a pioneer in the field of super graphics. This is a city that loves its super graphics. So yes, in many senses, she sort of channeled and built on the LA sensibility.
Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's Architecture and Design Show, DNA, and you can find out more about Deborah Sussman on Frances's blog. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, Julie Myers here to round out the show with the mail.
Hello. I do have the mail. I'd like to point out that we're both wearing flashy, colorful neckwear today in honor
pink.
I have pink, green, blue, orange, yellow. It's a veritable explosion of colors on a collar. But anyway, in honor of Deborah Sussman today.
Yes.
Feedback. On to feedback. We talked about a highly controversial story on the show today. The Ice Bucket Challenge. Madeline. We wanted to hear from people who've done it and those who have opted out. On Facebook, Mark Chavez says, I haven't dumped a bucket of water over my head, nor will I. It's great that it's for charity, but it seems a bit absurd, right? But Nathan DeRusha, also on Facebook, responded directly to Mark. He says, how is this an absurd trend? The results of the ALS challenge are irrefutably positive. So people have very strong feelings about this whole dumping water over your head. Strong feelings from Carlo, who called in to weigh in. He has been challenged to dump ice water over his head 3 times. Here's what he had to say.
Every time I get challenged, I always put a post up on Facebook or whatever social media out there in regards to water charities that are out there to bring clean water to countries in West Africa that don't have the luxury of dumping clean water in themselves. While I think it's a noble cause to donate to the ALS research, I agree with the sentiment that the ALS research is kind of at the back of the whole challenge, and more so the celebrity and the ice bucket dumping is more of the attention to this challenge.
I have to tell you, though, watching Anna Wintour dump ice water over her head and get her famous bob soaking wet.
That is definitely worth
seeing. That raised a certain amount of awareness in me. I don't know. I thought that was pretty interesting. But Carlo also said, you know, we're in a drought in California. How are we dumping buckets of water onto the ground? I guess we've collectively dumped 5 million gallons over our heads since the challenge started.
Really? We could use that 5 million gallons right here in Southern California. All right, Julie Myers, thank you very much for that. If you would like to weigh in on anything you hear on this show or anything at all, our Facebook is KCRW Press Play and our voicemail 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Barbara Bogave is filling in for Warren Olney up at 1 o'clock on To The Point, and I will see you tomorrow.